Today at Reader's Corner, Jim Sterba, author of Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds.
By about 1960, we were about one-third urban, one-third rural, and one-third suburban. By the year 2000, an absolute majority of people lived not in cities, but in suburbs, exurbs, and rural housing. We've become a nation of forest dwellers. If you draw a line around that eastern forest from the Atlantic coast out to the Great Plains, you would have drawn a line today around almost two-thirds of the American population and two-thirds of its forests in the contiguous 48.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. We all know we're in wild animal habitat when we enter the campground. Leave food unattended and you might find yourself in a battle with a bear. But what if the battleground was your own backyard? In Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds, author Jim Sterba walks us through our shared history with numerous North American wildlife species, how we nearly wiped them out, and how we have brought them back in force. Backyard battles with geese, deer, raccoons, feral cats, and wild turkeys are regular occurrences for a growing number of Americans. Without meaning to, many of us have created more attractive habitats than animals can find elsewhere. At the same time, most Americans spend 90% of their time indoors, where TV images of photogenic wildlife don't coincide with the reality of wild animals living nearby. Jim Sterba has been a foreign correspondent, war correspondent, and national news reporter for more than three decades for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. He joins us by phone for this interview. Jim Sterba, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Gee, thanks for having me.
Well, this seems like it's a little bit off the beaten path for Jim Sterba, the war correspondent and the foreign correspondent. I read this book and I feel like I'm reading a book written by a wildlife biologist. How'd you get into this particular subject?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Michigan, and after coming back from Asia in the 80s, I went home and took a close look at the landscape and how it had changed since I was a kid on a small farm in the central part of the state. The trees were coming back. A lot of that farmland was growing up in forests. Family farms weren't being farmed anymore. Deer were moving south. Pheasants that we used to hunt when I was a kid were all but gone because their habitat, the farmland, was gone. And I just started looking into the explosion of deer. And I remembered from my Asian days that the size of various armies in the world. So I started looking up deer hunting. There were about 11 or 12 million deer hunters in those days. And I thought to myself, that's a lot of armed firepower out in the countryside in November. Pennsylvania has a deer hunting population twice the size of the U.S. Army, and yet the deer population was exploding, and I was trying to figure out why, and I discovered that we've become a nation of sprawl people and that we live increasingly in the forest, and in the sprawl, there's lots of restrictions against hunting, and hunters their numbers were declining, and they could no longer control deer populations in lots of areas. So instead of having 10 to 15 deer per square mile, as you would have in, say, an unpeopled landscape, there's 60, 80, 100 deer per square mile in some areas of exurban and rural sprawl.
And then when it comes to the people side of the equation, you talk about how we as Americans have become denatured. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, as you said, we spend most of our time indoors or in our cars or in our offices, and then this phenomenon that began at the end of the 19th century, where authors like Jack London wrote books about wild creatures and they gave them human characteristics. These animals could think and they had feelings and so on, and that carried over into movies. The Disney ones are the most obvious, but there were a lot of other ones, too. And then TV shows in which wildlife was portrayed more or less as pets and children and so on, with those kind of characteristics. And there was no corrective of us going out into nature and seeing what they were really like. So the result is that when a wild creature turns up, let's say a bear turns up in your garbage or eating your bird feed or seed, the tendency is not to scare it away, but to throw it a donut or a cookie or something, and the bear begins to associate the smell of humans not with fear, but with food, comes back, and pretty soon the bear is trying to break into your house, and people call 911, and the bear sometimes gets darted and moved, but he still has this new knowledge that humans provide food, so he does it again. And in many states, that happens two or three strikes, and the bear gets euthanized. And it's not the bear's fault, it's the people's fault. And that's one of the problems with these population increases. People don't know how to deal with them because they've become, as I said, denatured.
For Westerners who are looking back, and by the way, out here in Boise, we call anything east that is on the other side of Nebraska, I think. So I'm from the Midwest, but when I live out here, I'm from the east. And when I talk to folks who really don't know the East very well, especially the Eastern Corridor, which you talked a bit about in your book, because that's, of course, where you live, we think of traffic, we think of congestion, sprawling suburbs. We don't think of reforestation, which you talk about in your book. We don't think of these reforested areas of the country that are growing that have become these rather large corridors. Help us understand that. I mean, maybe you can see some of that from the air, but for folks who don't even travel out there by air, I thought your book was a bit revealing for some who might not have the same image of the East as you give us.
One of the misunderstandings I think a lot of people have is where the forests in this country are and were. Initially, three-quarters of the forests in the contiguous 48 states were in the eastern third of the country, that is, from the Atlantic Ocean out to where the trees run out in the Great Plains. And that's the area that was called the Western Wilderness, even though mainly because it was just west of where people started from. And a lot of those trees were cut down by settlers and to get them out of the way for cropland and so on. And amazingly, those forests began to grow back in the early 19th century as farmland in New England was abandoned because it's not a very good place to grow stuff. The season's short. There are a lot of hills and rocks and so on. And when the Midwest opened up, when the Erie Canal opened up in 1825 and the Cumberland Gap earlier and so on, people streamed out there. They found this great land. They started farming it. And gradually, trees took a lot of this land back. And so now, an amazing 60% of that eastern forest is reforested again. In New England, it's 80%. And take a state like Connecticut, for example, the fourth most densely populated state in the country. It's 60% forested, and the former head of the Yale Forestry School used to say that if you look down on Connecticut in the summer, you'd see almost nothing but forest. If you looked down at Connecticut in the late fall after the leaves have fallen off the trees, you'd see almost nothing but stockbrokers. And what he was saying was that there's a whole lot of people living in a forest. And so what I say is that we've become a nation of forest dwellers. And in fact, if you draw a line around that eastern forest, again from the Atlantic coast out to the Great Plains, you would have drawn a line today around almost two-thirds of the American population and two-thirds of its forests in the contiguous 48.
And yet you mentioned going back in history to the time when trees were being leveled. The late 19th century, I think you referred to as the era of extermination as far as the wildlife populations are concerned, but that certainly changed.
The same thing happened with the forest. The low point in tree cover was about 1880. And remember, Henry David Thoreau was writing from Walden Pond in the 1850s and 60s, which was at about a low point. And, you know, there was probably less wilderness when he was writing than there was at any time before or after. So the trees were at their low point, their historic lows. The wildlife in this era of extermination was just decimated by market hunters, these commercial hunters that killed everything with any value for fur, feathers, meat, whatever. And there were no seasons, no limits, no rules. And they simply remember, and also the population had increased. Immigration just burgeoned in the 19th century. So you had all these people, all this stuff was cheap, and these guys made a good living killing, you know, any wild thing that moved, waterfowl, deer. And, of course, we paid for our settlements, and we paid for our trips across the Atlantic earlier by selling beaver pelts and deer hides back to the Europeans. So the era of extermination kicked in a backlash, which was called the conservation movement. I mean, people actually began to believe something that nobody had thought of before, that we could actually run out of wildlife, we could run out of trees, and not to mention the erosion and other environmental damage that that deforestation had caused. So this was a big turning point, and this is the point at which we began to bring these things back. The trees came back on their own because we got out of the way, and the wildlife came back because we proactively brought it back.
You're listening to Jim Sterba. He's the author of Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turn backyards into battlegrounds. So these conservationists, as you say, go to work in protecting the species and restoring the habitats. But here we are in the 21st century, and we have too many people bumping up against too many animals. How did we get to the point where we actually have this animal problem that we'll talk about here in a few minutes as we take apart the species?
After the Second World War, there was this tremendous housing shortage. Veterans came home, didn't have any place to live. And so with the government's help, they created suburbs housing on the edge of town, you know, the Levitt towns and these other near suburbs. And the government gave people help on mortgages and so on. And people started moving out of the cities and into their own homes. And they just kept moving because gas was cheap and you could buy a house. Roads were improved. You could get out further out of town, buy a acre lot or something, build yourself a house. And that, by about 1960, that phenomenon broke up the population so that we were about one-third urban, one-third rural, and one-third suburban. By the year 2000, an absolute majority of people, according to the census, lived not in cities or not on working farms, but in this vast sprawl area in between, this kind of middle muddle of suburbs, exurbs, and rural housing. That was, remember, small family farms at one point, now grown up in the forests, really good habitat for lots of species of wildlife, which we improved by our own living habits.
Along the way, the conservationists also went to work on changing the law in the sense of protecting species. And it seems like every species you identify in your book, there's some issue where there's just a heck of a lot more of them today than we need, at least in the United States. And that has to do, to some extent anyway, with how they've been protected.
Well, in order to stop commercial hunting, laws were enacted, and there was no enforcement at first because nobody wanted to enforce them. But slowly, wildlife wardens were named and so on, and gradually this enforcement kicked in. So they ended commercial hunting and poaching and said that, okay, the what's called the North American model of wildlife conservation, all this wildlife belongs to all the people. And we'll manage it as government entities for everybody if you'll abide by the rules. The rules are you can hunt and trap and photograph or do whatever what you want if you obey seasons, bag limits, and so on. And one of the interesting laws that didn't get enacted until 1935 was one that outlawed the use of live decoy flocks of ducks and geese. People don't realize that instead of these wooden things and the plastic ones you buy from Cabela's, that in the old days, people had flocks of live birds that they took out, and the geese would honk when they heard migrating flocks come over and lure the migrating flocks in to be killed by the market hunters or sporting clubs on the Chesapeake and whatever. Those birds were outlawed in 1935, and they were snatched up by all sorts of state wildlife people and others. You know, perhaps some people in small towns wanted a couple of geese on the town square or next to the peacock or whatever, but the state fish and wildlife people, because migrating flocks had been decimated so much, bought up these, or were given in many cases, these decoy birds, and they stocked them in refuges that they created all over the place to try to bring these decimated migrating flocks back. They thought the geese would take up migration again, but they never did. And the reason was because, you know, you migrate up to the Arctic to where you were born and learned how to fly, where, you know, what you called home. Well, these geese were already home. They were born and raised for many, many generations in these decoy flocks right there in the center of the country. So they stayed put. And they are the geese that are now overrunning our golf courses and soccer fields and parks and so on. And they're the ones that brought down U.S. Airways Flight 1549 in the Hudson a while back. People think global warming made them stop migrating, but no, we made them stop migrating maybe many, many dozens of generations ago.
Well, you'd find a lot of Boiseans who could chime in on this one, because we've got way more geese than we need. Let's talk about feral cats in the U.S. There was a recent article in the New York Times that so many of us saw, a new Fish and Wildlife Service study that found free-roaming cats were much deadlier than anyone realized and were responsible for killing 2.4 billion birds and 12.3 billion mammals a year. And you address in your book, I believe you do, the trap, neuter, and return issue. I wonder if you could comment on that and the role that it's playing in this problem.
Well, you know, the people who advocate trap, neuter, return were the first to jump on that study the other day and call it cooked. And this is just another example of using phony statistics to demonize these poor little kitties. You know, trap, neuter, return means that you trap these feral cats where they are. You neuter them so they can't have new cats. And then, most controversially, you put them back where you found them.
Right.
And for the people who like birds, well, you're putting them back so that they can continue to be predators. And remember, cats are a mid-sized North African predator that is an introduced species. And over the years, cats have been really easy to acquire and even more easy to throw away if you have problems with them. And that's what caused these problems. Just to give you some numbers, I say in the book that in 1947 there were about 4 million cats in this country. Today there are 173 million cats in this country, and about half of them are feral. And if you look at the total cat population, remember this is an introduced species, there are more cats on the landscape in this country today than cattle, pigs, sheep, and goats combined at any one time. I mean, that's a lot of animals. And, you know, if you have too many deer, they're going to do ecosystem damage. And, of course, people say that feral cats are doing enormous damage, as this study indicated, to wildlife populations, to birds and small mammals and so on. But the cat people are very compassionate and very caregiving, and they think that they can solve this problem eventually. But even the American Veterinary Medical Association says that what they're doing is a drop in the bucket in an ocean of need, because they're, no matter how many cats you neuter and follow this program, you're still not decreasing the cat population, except in maybe some very localized areas. There are lots of people who say it doesn't work, and that this is a real menace to the ecosystems of lots of other creatures that are native to this country.
You're listening to Jim Sterba. He's the author of Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turn backyards into battlegrounds. As you and I are talking about these species and running these down one by one, I'm thinking of a term you use in your book, identifying the people that come to the rescue of each of these species. You call them species partisans. And so let's move to a species where there might not be quite as many partisans. Maybe not as many people are into beavers. Tell us about the American beaver and the role it has played through history and how it's really made a miraculous comeback.
Well, you know, the beaver was the first commodity animal in this country. Fishermen way back before the first settlers arrived in the Gulf of Maine found that they could pay Indians for their beaver pelts and make a heck of a lot more money selling them back in Europe than they could sell their salted cod, which they caught in the Gulf. And this animal really paid for the early settlement of North America. The explorers and traders and then settlers paid Indians to kill millions and millions of beaver. So the beavers were wiped out before settlers got here. For 100 years, beavers were trapped before Jamestown and Plymouth Colony colonists actually arrived. They arrived, there were no beavers. And as people moved inland, there were no beavers where they settled. But there were the results of beavers having been there for years, riverside meadows and so on. So the beavers are all being trapped out as we move west. And then finally in our infrastructure, all of the roads, the railroads, the utility lines, and the other infrastructure that we built was built on old beaver habitat. I mean, the lowlands. Why go over a mountain when you could build around the mountain or build along the stream and so on? So beavers were reduced to remnants, and then the conservation movement and the state fish and wildlife people decided that, you know, we need, after the Dust Bowl years, discovered that wetlands had a purpose and that beavers could create them because they're one of the few species like us that can re-engineer the landscape for their own purposes. So we started bringing them back and brought them back from Canada and put them in the Adirondacks in the east, and their populations grew because there weren't any wolves and other major beaver predators around, and they were protected from trappers. So they grew and they spread, and they're now called by the U.S. Department of Agriculture possibly the single most costly damaging species of wildlife out there. One example in the book, Columbia, South Carolina, signed a contract with a guy for $1 million. These are tax dollars at work to clean out the beavers and their dams from their water systems, their sewer systems, and their drainage ditches and so on. I mean, they can flood water supplies, septic tanks, you know, they can flood your driveway. And there are all these anti-trapping rules that have been passed in many states, which prevent, actually, trappers were the last predator around for beavers in many places. And they're kind of remnants. They're mostly weekend guys and so on, especially in the east. And so what's happened is there's a booming business in not only nuisance wildlife control, but beaver control, beaver mitigation. I have a friend in the book that I quote as saying, you know, I called myself a beaver trapper until a few years ago, and now I'm a nuisance wildlife control professional. Instead of getting $20 a beaver pelt, I get $150 for taking out a nuisance beaver. And if someone wants to put in a beaver deceiver, which is a system of pipes that's set up to stop flooding but to allow the beavers to remain in their little pond, you know, that costs $1,500, $2,000 and so on. And he now only works for corporations and railroads and others who want him to proactively monitor the landscape so that the beavers don't cause serious damage to, say, railroad right-of-ways. If they back up too much water, they can flood the roadbeds and you can have potential train derailments and so on. So they're a really fun and interesting species, and they're a lot bigger than people think they are. They're really, I call them the 50-pound rodent in the book. And we have a weekend place about 100 miles north of New York City, and there's a big wetlands out and back, and we have all sorts of beaver dams and ponds, and my wife feeds them apples on occasion, and they're really interesting creatures.
That sounds kind of like in violation of some of the things you're talking about in this book, when people are getting too close to these animals and
encouraging them. Well, my wife feeds the birds around our house, too.
So right.
The pond out back, you know, the raccoons and the turkeys come in our backyard, and of course the deer are all over the place. So we share the problems, and we're as guilty as others are in creating a habitat that's inviting to many of these species.
What about the bear population in the United States? You talk about bear baiting, and of course it's banned in some states, but I come away with the impression that you might think we've restricted bear hunting to the point where there's too many bears on the planet or in the country when you put them alongside too many people. Something has to give.
Well, if you don't do what I talked about earlier, bears are not really troublesome. But remember, as all these populations grow, they spread. Beavers are kicked out of their lodges when they're 2 years old, and they have to go find some new body of water to dam. Bears, the same way, get kicked out when they're yearlings. And if they don't, they could be eaten by other bears or killed by big males that think they're intruding on their habitat. So as these populations grow, they spread. And where do they spread? They spread into where we live, because we're out there. We're ubiquitous on the landscape. And in some areas, you know, in Maine, where they defeated a ballot initiative that would have restricted bear baiting and use of dogs, the bear hunters claim that without these, they couldn't kill enough bears, and pretty soon bears were going to overrun people and were going to cause problems. And that pretty soon, and everyone's worst nightmare is that the bear breaks into the house and kills someone. This rarely happens, but you know, the Fish and Game Departments have to euthanize many bears a year in places like Colorado and Florida and so on, where they do become habituated to humans. And I don't know what's going to happen as the populations grow. I mean, we've got bears around us right up there in Dutchess County, New York, and they were in the birdseed of the guy next door about 100 yards away, they're going to multiply and they're going to spread, and we're going to have to learn to live with them and take to heart the little bumper sticker that says a fed bear is a dead bear. And we're going to have to learn to take down our bird seed, our bird feeders, and bear proof our mulch piles and garbage cans and so on. But I think the situation is going to get worse as these populations grow. I mean, Connecticut, of all places, has more than 100 moose, and Massachusetts has maybe 1,200. The moose car crashes are a lot worse, as you know, out there than deer car crashes. People die a lot.
In an effort to restore this healthy balance in our environment, I think you have a term you use called cut, cull, and kill. What does that mean?
I think one of the guys who wrote a blurb for the book used that phrase. I didn't use it in my book, but in the case of deer management, for example, once you get deer populations to the point where they are causing a lot of ecosystem damage, the landscape damage, deer car crashes, and they're accused of spreading Lyme disease, of course, people recommend reducing them by culling them, using sharpshooters, bringing in bow hunters, and other sort of regulated systems of reducing the population. I can give you an example. Princeton, New Jersey, which is a township that holds Princeton University and the Institute for Advanced Study. I mean, they fought, like most towns, for 10 years probably over what to do with too many deer, whether there were too many deer, how can you kill deer, what should we do? And finally, in the year 2000, they hired a 501c3 company called White Buffalo to come in and sharpshoot the deer. And these become real emotional fights. But gradually, Princeton has been doing deer culls. They get the population down from, say, 2,000 at first down to about 300, so people who want to see deer still can. But the deer that are there have more deer, and the population slowly grows, and it gets up to about 500-600, and then they bring in the cullers again and kill them, and the meat goes to food pantries and so on, so it's not wasted, and that's how they manage the deer herd, but it's costing Princeton taxpayers to do it.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for coming onto the show, and thanks for the book again. For our listeners, it's Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds by Jim Sterba. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Next week, Michael Grunwald, author of The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.